My topic tonight is expendability for God. Expendability is one of the radical differences between a Christian and a non-Christian. And there should be a good many radical differences. You ought to be able to look around and point to a Christian in any crowd, because they're different. And I wonder how many people you know to whom you could point and say to a non-Christian, watch him. That's what I mean by a Christian. We will be thinking tonight and tomorrow about several different aspects of that radical difference. But tonight, let's consider what we mean by expendability. And if I had the opportunity, I would like to ask each person here, what matters most to you in all the world? What is the most important thing in the world to you? When my little grandson Walter was 5 years old, we were walking down the street one time, and I said to him, Walter, what do you want more than anything else in the world? And instead of giving me a fast answer, I really expected him to say a diesel backloader or something, because he was just completely carried away with earth-moving equipment of all kinds. And he stopped, and he looked up at me, and he said, Granny, I want to be a good brother. Well, he had two little sisters, and there aren't too many five-year-old boys who are particularly fond of their little sisters, let alone ever think of being a good brother. But I thought, now there is a radical distinction between a little five-year-old boy who loves God and a five-year-old boy who doesn't. I really believed that God was already at work in that little boy's heart. I think he still is. But what matters most to you in all the world? Just this last week, I was reading a magazine in which there was an interview with a certain very popular television interviewer, a woman, and she was talking about her live-in boyfriend. And they then, of course, interviewed the live-in boyfriend for some of his commentary, and they asked him if he was planning to marry this woman. And he said something like, well, I don't know, we've only lived together for a year or two. And he said, I'm 33 or 35, and I don't want to get myself tied up with somebody that I'm not sure I'd be happy with for the rest of my life. Because, he said, my own happiness matters more to me than anything else. I thought that was a breathtaking admission of the bankruptcy of a non-believer. And what I found more breathtaking was that any woman would consent to live with a man like that. Now, some of you men may be realizing that the shoe fits, that maybe that's really the case with you, that your happiness matters more than anything else in the world, but probably we don't have anybody in this room like that tonight. I hope there isn't any wife here who's thinking, well, if my husband doesn't realize it, the shoe sure fits him. Does your own happiness matter more to you than anything else in the world? Well, it certainly ought to be one of the radical distinctions between Christians and non-Christians, that a Christian's happiness is way down the list. You know, ancient Greeks regarded goodness as the most important thing. And modern man, generally speaking, would probably agree with that boyfriend. They regard happiness as the most important thing. But a Christian recognizes that true goodness leads to true happiness. They're never contradictory. The world's notion is that if there is a God and he's up there, then his main object in life is to ruin our fun. And nothing that's any fun is good. Or you've heard people say, everything that I like is either illegal or immoral or fattening. We were at a theological seminary just 2 weeks ago, and we were talking with one of the first-year students there, a young man that we've known for several years, And I was asking him what his impressions were of this seminary. And he said, you know, I'd like to get through to some of these men here. He said, they are so darn selfish. And I thought, what a sad commentary. Here are full-grown men, graduate level, many of them married, and this young man was talking about married men. He himself has been married just about a year. And already he had noticed that there was a great deal of selfishness in the lives of men who are going into full-time service for Christ. Paul said, I'm ready to spend and to be spent for you. He was expendable. He was prepared to lay down his life. And I'm going to do something tonight that I've never done before in my life, but as I was preparing this talk, I realized that I had written a chapter for a book, which incidentally just went into the mail yesterday to the publisher, which was saying some of the things which I intended to say tonight, but I think I probably say them better on paper. So tonight I'm going to read you a chapter from this book. And I think you'll see how it fits into this question of expendability. Some months ago, public television showed the marvelous story of the emperor penguin of the Antarctic. The males incubate the eggs. I will not soon forget the scene. Acres and acres of ice, surrounded by the frigid sea and the nearly black sky, wind whistling across the desolate expanse on which stood, still as statues, thousands of father penguins, each holding on top of his feet a single egg, protected by a little coverlet of warm feathers. They stood for 3 months. By the time the chick pecked its way out of the egg, the father had nearly starved to death. At this point, the mother took over the care of the chick until the father had found food in the ocean, whereupon they took turns babysitting as long as the chick needed them. What a picture of fatherhood that is. Patience, sacrifice, responsibility, protection, provision. That is what fathers are for. They beget children, but that is only the beginning. The prophet Hosea pictures the father loving his children, calling them to godliness, teaching them to walk, taking them in his arms, leading them with bonds of love, lifting them to his cheek, bending down to feed them. Of God, he writes, in thee the fatherless find a father's love. I think of my own tall, spare, rather reticent, but very dear father, and how he would hold his tiny newborn in his big hands. I remember the births of three of my siblings. I think of how he took us for walks on Saturday afternoons, got down on his hands and knees and let two of us ride him like a horse around the dining room, or allowed us to sit clasping his calves on top of his size 12 feet as he strode around the room. In him we found a father's love. St. Paul was a spiritual father to many. The Corinthians were his dear children. You may have 10,000 tutors in Christ, but you have only one father, he wrote, for in Christ Jesus you are my offspring. To the Thessalonians, he wrote, we dealt with you one by one as a father deals with his children, appealing to you by encouragement as well as by solemn injunctions to live lives worthy of the God who calls you into his kingdom and glory. Scripture has very strong things to say about fathers who fail to take responsibility for their children. Eli, who had been a judge over Israel for 40 years, had never judged his own sons. The child Samuel, his servant in the temple, was sent to him with a message from God. You are to tell him that my judgment on his house shall stand forever, because he knew of his sons' blasphemies against God and did not rebuke them. The two sons were killed in battle. The ark of God was taken, and this news was the death of old Eli. May not God judge men who have refused accountability to God for spiritual sons? Who is to shoulder the weight if men refuse? A father, according to the prophet Isaiah, is to be like a peg. On him shall hang all the weight of the family, down to the lowest dregs, all the little vessels, both bowls and pots. Many readers have not known a godly and loving father. Many, such as my daughter, have not known their own fathers at all. Yet the biblical picture shows us what fatherhood is meant to be. While the fathers of families have a clear and unavoidable responsibility for their children in the flesh, ought not all Christian men, married or single, think of themselves as in some measure spiritually responsible for others? May they opt out of fatherly care just because they have no biologically begotten children? Is not God calling them to forsake selfishness and to cease to live for themselves, to grow up to full manhood and put away childish things, which doesn't mean picking up the Legos from the kitchen floor or the skateboards from the front steps? My second husband used to say that when he became a man, he began to put away childish things. In other words, he was always having to pick up his kids' toys. My second husband, incidentally, is not Lars. Lars is number three. My second one died of cancer. Masculinity means responsibility. One reason for the loneliness of many men is their aimlessness. They do not see where they are needed. They live for themselves. Isaiah describes the watchmen of Israel as blind and unaware. They are all dumb dogs who cannot bark, stretched on the ground, dreaming, lovers of sleep, greedy dogs that can never have enough. They are shepherds who understand nothing. Absent, each of them on his own pursuits, each intent on his own gain wherever he can find it. Remember, this is Isaiah talking. This is not Elizabeth Elliot. Some of these watchmen surely are single. It has not crossed their minds that if they have no families of their own to care for, they might become watchmen and shepherds, spiritual fathers to others who need them badly. Have not single men a special responsibility to sacrifice themselves in ways that married men are not free to do? The possibilities of spiritual paternity are often actually enhanced by singleness. The celibacy of the priesthood and the vows of chastity taken by the religious throughout the ages of Christian history testify to this truth, as have the fruits of singleness in the lives of many others. And a few examples from some of those biographies that have affected my life. Look, for example, at David Brainerd, a young unmarried man who begat spiritual sons among Indians of New Jersey in the 18th century. Look at J.O. Fraser, who went to southwest China at the age of 22 and gave himself for the Lisu tribespeople, picking them up in his arms, as it were, and carrying them as a father carries his children. A bachelor until past 40, he lived a life of patience, sacrifice, responsibility, protection, and provision, just like those penguins I told you about. For those people who had never before heard of Christ, it was a very lonely life for the only foreigner many of the people had ever seen. For months at a time, he traveled on foot or muleback to almost unreachable villages perched high in the snowy mountains. Fraser willingly received his loneliness and his singleness as part of the price of being a servant of the Lord. It was his daily offering. Spiritual parenthood is a door open to every man. It is not restricted to people of extraordinary gifts and calling. It is for anyone willing to follow the Master. You may be thinking, well, I'm not a penguin and I'm not a missionary. I think of my own brothers. I have four brothers. None of them has made a pile of money, but all have gained riches of another kind. All are fathers, both physically and spiritually. Phil, the oldest, father of two, has been a missionary in Northwest Territory for more than 35 years. He began in an out-of-the-way place called Mahaney, where he and his diminutive wife built a log cabin and traveled by dog sled in order to learn an unwritten Indian language so that they could give the gospel to people who did not have it. My brother Dave, father of four, was a missionary in Costa Rica and Colombia. and lives now in Singapore as director of the World Evangelical Fellowship. I meet his spiritual offspring often in my travels. Tom, father of two, is a writer and a teacher in secondary schools and colleges in England and the United States. He has spiritually fathered young people, trying to impart to them a wider and more glorious Christian vision. Jim, father of four, is the youngest. He is an artist, pastor of a small church in a small city, Cody, Wyoming. This answers the question of what they do professionally, but it tells only a small part of the spiritual fathering that they are doing. In fairly hidden ways, at home and in their towns, each has borne the burdens of others who have nothing to do with their jobs. I don't suppose any of them has thought of it, especially in this way. I've never asked them, but I see it. I know it's what they do, simply as a matter of course. I also know a little bit about the loneliness life has dealt out to them, though I've never heard one of them mention that word. They are men, each possessing a measure of the simplicity and patience they learned from our Father. Any man who puts himself at the disposal of God will sooner or later find that he cannot live for himself. God will see to it that needs are laid at his doorstep. His office, his neighborhood, his church, his club, his circle of friends, which he cannot ignore. It has to be my life for yours. And that, it seems to me, should be a Christian's watchword. Not, it's my life and I'm going to do with it what I want. You know what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6. You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body. We are expendable. We're here to be servants, as you sang tonight. We're here to spend and to be spent. And maybe from time to time to be walked all over. Have you ever heard anybody say, well, what are we supposed to be, a doormat? Well, what is a Christian supposed to be? Scripture says in Philippians 2 that we should have the same frame of mind that Jesus had. And that passage tells us that Jesus made himself nothing. That's less than a doormat, isn't it? Yes, the answer is yes. We are supposed to be doormats from time to time. Not necessarily all the time, but Jesus said if somebody slaps you on the right cheek, then turn him the other one. If somebody takes your coat, give him your cloak. If somebody wants you to go 1 mile, go two. Expendability. The modern man is looking for a no-risk, no-fault, no-cost life. But a no-risk, no-fault, no-cost life equals no true Christianity. It's a no-faith life, isn't it? And the fundamental principle of the symbol of our faith, the symbol of our faith is a cross. What is the fundamental principle of that symbol? My life for yours. Wasn't that what Jesus was telling us when he died? It's sacrifice. It is a symbol of sacrifice. I am willing to be inconvenienced for you. As someone has said, the simplest definition of courtesy is the willingness to be inconvenienced in order that other people might never be inconvenienced. Isn't that a good way to put it? And courtesy certainly should be one of the outstanding characteristics of a Christian, because the principle of his life is my life for yours. I pass you the salt at the table first. It's a very tiny gesture, isn't it? But it's not an empty tradition. It really does mean something. It means you are more important to me than I am. If I offer you a chair, it's not because you can't find a chair for yourself. It's in order that you might not be inconvenienced. It's in order that I can say to you, my life for yours. Jesus said, or Paul says in Romans 12, this is probably a familiar verse to many of you, I'm reading from the New English Bible, I implore you by God's mercy to offer your very selves to Him, a living sacrifice, dedicated and fit for His acceptance, the worship offered by mind and heart. Another translation says that the presentation of this body is an act of spiritual worship. Now, I'm sure that there are some people here that have always had the idea that there's a spiritual realm of things and there's a physical realm, and there's no connection between them. We're spirit, soul, and body, but there's not really much connection between them. When we come to church, we do spiritual things, and when we go home, we do ordinary things. Well, that's really not the way it's supposed to work for a Christian, is it? Everything that we do, Paul said, even if we're eating and drinking, should be for the glory of God. And to me, this verse helps me to understand this. When I present this body, this is a very physical body, isn't it? Very earthy. I have to feed it, and I have to sleep, and I have to exercise. But the presentation of this body to Jesus Christ is an act of spiritual worship. Now, that ought to settle in our minds forever, whether we should make a real distinction between physical and spiritual. We shouldn't. Christian doctrine has never taught that. There have been all kinds of heresies that have taught that. There was monism and deism and Gnosticism and many heresies that have plagued the church throughout Christian history, where they say the body is bad, but the spirit is good. And everything that's invisible is good and everything that's visible is bad. That is heresy. Don't buy that line. We are to present our bodies as a living sacrifice. And that means everything that this body does, my work, my time, my possessions, my mind, my emotions, all of this is part of that living sacrifice. My whole life, in other words, is an offering to Jesus Christ. Sunday morning you come with your offering and you put it in the plate. That doesn't mean that only that dollar bill belongs to God, does it? What a Christian is saying when he puts that dollar bill in the plate is, this is a token. It's just a little sign that all my money belongs to God because all of me belongs to God. But I put this visible token in to signify that my whole life is an offering. So now let's get to the story of five men. I want to tell you one more 20th century example of what expendability is all about. There were five young missionaries in Ecuador. I'd like to tell you a little bit about who they were and where they came from. One of them was Nate Saint. He was from Philadelphia. He was the founder, one of the founders of the Missionary Aviation Fellowship. He was a very funny guy. I knew Nate Saint. He had a terrific sense of humor. He was a genius in inventing things. He had built himself a hydroelectric plant on a little tiny stream in the jungle, so he was able to supply his whole house with electricity. He had invented various things for helping jungle pilots, and he was a very, very skilled pilot. Nate had gone to Ecuador back in the late 40s and was working in the eastern jungle, serving all of the jungle stations with his little plane. And 5 minutes of flying time saved a missionary one whole day of travel. Then there was a young man from Wyoming by the name of Roger Udarian. He was a cowboy, or perhaps from Montana. I've forgotten which it was. Roger Udarian had become a paratrooper in World War II. He was wounded and eventually ended up in the eastern jungle of Ecuador working with a very notorious tribe of Indians called the Jivaros, famous for their method of shrinking human heads. After they had chopped their enemies' heads off, then they would shrink them down to the size of an orange with the features still entirely recognizable and the hair still attached, and they would string them around their belts by way of visual aids to their enemies. Occasionally they would put them up on poles around their houses as well. Very fierce tribe of Indians where Raj Udarian was working. Then there was a man from Seattle, Washington, very bookish type. He had decided to go into an academic career. He was going to get a PhD in literature. He had a master's degree already from the University of Washington when God called him to the jungle of eastern Ecuador, where he worked with Quechua Indians. Then there was a young man that I had known as a student at Wheaton College. He was a football player. He was a track man. Very tall, very handsome. We girls all thought he was just what we used to call a dreamboat back in those days. He could play a very mean trombone. He was president of his class. When the Hearst newspapers sponsored an oratorical contest for college and university students nationwide, Ed McCulley won first place. We had no doubt that he would succeed as a politician, which was his ambition. In fact, we had no trouble imagining Ed McCulley as president of the United States. He went to law school when he graduated from college, and then in various ways, God changed his mind, and he went to the jungle of South America to work also with the Quechua Indians of the eastern jungle of Ecuador. Then the fifth man was the one that I knew the best. He was a college student also with me, had been in the same class with Ed McCulley. They were buddies back then, and I used to be one of many girls that thought Jim Elliott was just by far the most attractive man on the campus. One of the things that was particularly attractive about him was that he never dated anybody. And, you know, if a guy doesn't seem to be the least bit vulnerable to the opposite sex, then you begin to wonder about that man, and he has an aura of mystery about him. And he was also very handsome and athletic. He was a wrestler. They called him the India Rubber Man because he was capable of being tied into knots that you wouldn't believe, but never was pinned. And he won the championship of four states in his weight class. He was a campus clown, kind of guy that people were always asking to stand up and do some stand-up comedy. He could recite Robert Service's poetry, things like The Face on the Barroom Floor, or The Shooting of Dan McGrew, or The Cremation of Sam McGee. He was the president of the Foreign Missions Fellowship, so he was a spiritual leader, not just an athlete, not just a campus clown, but also a spiritual leader. And he was a scholar. We had honors convocations every semester, and every semester with boring regularity we heard the name of Jim Elliott read out, and he graduated with highest honor in classical Greek. A very interesting collection of men, and the kind of men who undoubtedly could have made themselves a pile of money in probably more than one field if they had chosen to do so. Men whom their friends and even their families tried to dissuade from going to the mission field because they had so many gifts and they had such a tremendous, quote, ministry. You know, there's a real snare in that word ministry, because we have this idea that we want to serve God in a particular way. We all have our own ideas about how we would like to serve God. And if God has given you talents in a certain area or experience or gifts, then you think, now this is the place where I've got to serve God, and I'm not going to do anything until I can find the slot where these gifts are going to be recognized or utilized. It doesn't always work that way. And I think my descriptions of these men would be sufficient to show you that they probably could have been quite successful if they had stayed in this country. Jim and Ed also had had a radio program, and they had taken turns preaching on that radio for about a year. I still have some of those tapes, and to tell you the truth, they really sound like Billy Graham, both of them. They had prison ministry. They had ministry with a bunch of kids that they called the River Rats on the Mississippi where they were working. And they did street corner preaching, and there were just all kinds of things that they could do in this country. And so their friends said to them what people usually say to foreign missionaries, why do you go overseas when there's all this to do in your backyard? Well, of course, Jesus told the disciples that they were to go to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria and to the uttermost parts of the earth. Well, if they had decided that they couldn't go to Judea until they had finished evangelizing Jerusalem, they'd still be there, wouldn't they? They would never have gotten beyond that, because there will always be plenty to do in your own backyard. That is not why missionaries go overseas. They go overseas because Jesus said that the gospel is for every people and tribe and tongue and nation. So, in one way or another, God put his finger on each of those five men, and they ended up in the eastern jungle of Ecuador. Well, after Jim had been a missionary for about a year working with the Quechua Indians, he proposed to a missionary in the West Jungle, a woman who was working with the Colorado Indians, and of course that was I, so Jim and I were married later on in the capital city of Ecuador, Quito, and we were working on the reduction to writing of the Quechua language, the jungle Quechua dialect, which had never been reduced to writing. When one day our pilot, Nate Saint, flew in to our station with the usual supplies of medicine and meat and gasoline and mail and the things which he routinely brought to us. But on this particular day in 1955, he came with a very exciting piece of news that he had finally discovered the whereabouts of a tribe of Indians called the Aucas. We knew generally where the Aucas lived. We knew of their existence. We also knew that they were Stone Age people, that they were naked, and that they had never once let any outsider leave the tribe. A number of people had gone in there looking for oil and rubber and gold, and not one had ever been heard from again. So we, of course, took it for granted that they killed these people. And for years, missionaries had been praying that someday, missionaries and other people had been praying that someday God would enable somebody to take the gospel to these people. So when Nate flew into our station called Shandia in 1955 and told us, "I've discovered some inhabited Auca houses," this was a thrilling piece of news to us, because we were among those who had been praying for these people. And Jim had written in his journal, "Lord, send me to the Aucas." He had prayed before he ever got out of college that the Lord would send him someday to people who had never heard the name of Christ. And so began what the men called Operation Auca, Nate Saint's plan of dropping gifts to these people from a small plane. And week after week, Ed McCulley, that tract man and champion orator, took turns with Jim, and one or the other would fly with Nate and drop the gifts to these people. Nate was so skillful that he was able to fly right down between the tall trees and fly so low that they could actually see the expressions on the people's faces. They could see that they were naked. They could see week after week the gifts that the people had received the week before. They would be waving the pots or the machetes or whatever the men had given them, and gesturing with very friendly expressions, "Come, come and see us." Of course, they had no idea how that plane could ever come down, but they assumed that it could. And then Nate actually used an invention of his whereby he would fly in a huge circle of about a mile in diameter, lower a bucket gradually to the ground so that somebody on the ground could take a hold of the bucket, take out what was in it, and the Aucas were smart enough to do that. They grabbed the bucket, and then the following week, to our immense excitement, they returned a gift to us. And Nate, of course, pulled the bucket up from the plane, from the ground to the plane, and over the next few weeks we received a comb made of river reeds, a feather fan, a live parrot with a half-eaten banana in a little basket, and a cooked monkey leg. So we were convinced that the people had in fact accepted our overtures of friendship, and that they would be prepared perhaps to meet some outsiders face to face on the ground. And so then began the really serious part of the planning for a trip in there on foot to meet these people. And so it was in January of 1956 that five men joined together, Nate, Ed, Jim, and Pete from Seattle, and Raj, the cowboy from Montana. And they went in, they set up a camp, and they had 2 days later what appeared to be a very friendly contact with the Alka Indians. They reported back to us by shortwave radio, and we were tremendously excited. 2 days later, they called in again to say that they had seen from the air a number of Alkas approaching the camp. They said, "We'll call you again at 4:30 this afternoon." And at 4:30, there was nothing but silence. So it took 5 days before a ground party was able to reach their camp and report back to us wives that all of our husbands had been speared to death. Now, when that word reached us, of course, we thought of the words of a hymn which the men had sung on the eve of their departure. "We rest on thee, our shield and our defender." Now, I'd like you to think of what a Christian's response to a piece of news like that ought to be. Here were five men who could have been very successful in this country. Five men whose gifts were far beyond anything that the Indians would ever understand or appreciate. Five men who had trusted God, had obeyed Him, as far as they knew, to become missionaries, had heard the call to take the gospel to these unreached people, had risked their lives, and of course we knew very well what the possibilities were, and we had discussed as frankly and as candidly as we could what we would do if they didn't come back. Five men whom God had taught to trust Him to be their shield and their defender. And then God allowed them to be speared to death. Does that make your faith begin to totter? Does it make it collapse? Remember, these men already belonged to Him. They were expendable. And that was their attitude. Jim Elliot had written in my college yearbook the reference 2 Timothy 2:4. And the words there say, "A soldier on active service does not become entangled in civilian affairs. He must be wholly at his commanding officer's disposal." He was disposable. And that's what we all are, isn't it? We are at his orders, for his disposal. "Anything you say, Lord, it's my life for you." And Jim had prayed that God would work out his whole life, his whole will in his life. Jim had prayed, written this prayer in his journal, "I pray thee, God, light these idle sticks of my life and let me burn out for you." In another place he had written, "Have my blood, Lord. Have it all. Let it be poured out for the life of the world." It was not a no-risk, no-cost life that they were bargaining for. In one of Jim's love letters to me, and his love letters were very unusual, he once reminded me, "If you and I are the sheep of his pasture, don't ever forget that we are headed for an altar." The word is sacrifice. "I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice." Now, it may not be that anybody in this room is ever going to bleed to death on the point of a savage spear. There might be somebody who will. I certainly hope that I'm talking to some potential foreign missionaries. It may not be that anybody in this room is ever going to die a very dramatic death because of some particular form of service for Christ. But Jesus Christ is calling every single one of us to lay down our lives. If I were to ask you to quote John 3:16, I imagine quite a few of you could, but if I asked you to quote 1 John 3:16, I doubt that very many of you would have it on the tip of your tongue, but this is what it says, and it is the corollary to John 3:16, which says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. 1 John 3:16, it is by this that we know what love is, that Christ laid down his life for us. And we, in our turn, are bound to lay down our lives for our brothers. Now, those five men's death shook up the world. I mean, that news went around the world so fast. It was in the days of television's infancy. And Lars and I have been in some other countries. There's never been one place, I don't think, where we have gone, where we haven't seen somebody, when somebody hasn't told us that that testimony of those men has changed their lives. They spoke far more loudly in their death than they ever could have if they had lived. But they didn't just decide one Sunday night that they were going in to lay down their lives for the Alcas. They expected to come back, of course. But they had decided years before that they were expendable. In any way, anyhow, anywhere, that God chose to dispose of them. I repeat the question that I asked at the beginning. What matters most to you in all the world? Is it your happiness, or is it the glory of God? And I'm here to tell you tonight that there is no place in the whole world of true safety except the will of God. And there is no place in the whole world of true joy except the will of God. Maybe some of you know the old gospel hymn, trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. Expendability for God. Is your life at his disposal? Tomorrow we'll be talking about some of the very practical ways in which it ought to be, and it can be. God bless you.